At what point did David Hare know he was a playwright? He'll tell us when he talks about his new memoir, The Blue Touch Paper.
Finally, with Plenty, I felt the technique matched the subject matter and that the subject matter, as it were coming across without the audience being aware of the technique, and the technique was not clumsy and wasn't getting in the way.
What's Sarah Vowell's take on that revolutionary French aristocrat, the Marquis de Lafayette? She'll be here to talk about her new book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States.
Like his father, he wanted glory on the battlefield, and in order to achieve that, you need a battle. So that was another reason he came to America.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. David Hare joins us now. He is a playwright, obviously, and much more, and the author of a new memoir, The Blue Touch Paper. Hi, David.
Hello.
So explain this title.
Yes, I'm sorry about that. It's you see, in England, when you set off a firework, the expression is light the blue touch paper and retire. But unfortunately, you don't have a blue touch paper in America. But the blue fuse seemed to me such a terrible title.
Yeah, that's not good.
That my publishers very kindly allowed me to keep the title and for it to seem, I hope, mysterious and alluring to the American public.
I was going to say that's going to make your media tour very easy because you'll always know what the first question is going to be.
Well, it's essentially about my launching. In other words, it's the first 30 years of my life, and it's about me being launched as a playwright, becoming a playwright. It's what the Germans called a Bildungsroman. It's about how you become a writer.
Right.
And it interweaves my personal story with my artistic story and with also a little bit of social and political history of Britain in those 30 years. And so that's the bit where the rocket was launched.
And did you know that you always wanted to write a memoir, or did you resist the notion? Or how did you get pulled into this?
No, I'm a strongly non-autobiographical writer. And in fact, my work, I suppose, is characterized by writing about things like aid to the Third World, the Chinese Revolution, the privatization of the railways, the diplomatic process leading up to the war in Iraq. You know, I've spent my life trying to jemmy interesting material about the world into show business, which is traditionally resistant to these subjects. And I've always had my eye outwards on the world, not inwards on my soul. But because I wrote a play about my education, the children in it, the young actors in it who were teenagers, were completely riveted that the 1950s and 60s in England seemed so far away, so distant as Proust's world, really. And so I wrote it to explain to people who didn't live through the middle of the last century just how crazy it was.
And that play was?
It was called South Downs, and it was performed with a Terence Rattigan play called The Browning Version. He wrote about his education, and the Rattigan estate asked me to write a play to go with that one.
And so much about this in this book is about your education. You got into a very good school after growing up in a small town, right? How did you get to the Lansing School?
Yeah. I was a suburban boy, you know, from a lower middle class background, which is a classic writer's background. I was born in and brought up in one of the most boring towns in England.
It has a lovely name, though.
Bexhill-on-Sea.
Yes.
And Bexhill-on-Sea is really distinguished for absolutely nothing whatsoever. It's got the oldest average age of any town in the country. I put my curiosity down to the fact that every day since I was 13 and was sent away as a scholarship boy to a boarding school because my family could never have afforded to send me to a private school, I put my curiosity about the world down to a basic gratitude that every morning I wake up and say, well, at least I'm not in Bexhill-on-Sea.
So this is not a story of British sort of public school horrors.
No, it's much more a story of a boy who is forced up through the class system.
Mm-hmm.
And who finds that everybody else seems to understand the rules, but I don't understand the rules. It's not that I'm a rebel. It's not that I'm an anarchist. It's not that I'm anti-authority. I simply don't get what the flaming rules are. And everybody else seems to understand them. Everybody's behaving like they understand them. I don't. And it made me realize the degree to which my playwriting has been driven not, as people believe, by anger, but actually by bewilderment. And a play is a form of proposal, meaning, I see the world like this. Does anyone out there recognize the portrait that I am painting? if I write a successful play, a lot of people go, yep, that's exactly how the world seems to me. I've just never heard it expressed. An unsuccessful play, blank faces, and no, we don't recognize this at all.
I want to go right into one of your plays then, because it brings me naturally to it, which is Via Dolorosa, in which you very openly kind of asked those questions. You acted in it and then also wrote a book about that experience, Acting Up. I'm not sure. Was it ever published here?
Yeah, I mean, it was distributed.
It was distributed here,
probably here by Farrar Straus.
So this is not quite your first memoir, because that book. Tell us a little bit about
that.
No,
but that was a diary. You know, I wrote a diary of what it was like because I came back from Israel and the Palestinian Territory, as it was then called. This was at the end of the last century, and I was asked. I wanted to talk about my experiences, but the only way I could do that was by learning to act. And so Stephen Daldry taught me to act. And it was unusual to learn to act at the age of 50 because I'd never done it. And so I wrote a book about what acting seemed like to someone who had never done it in their life. But it wasn't really a book, it was a diary. The Blue Touch Paper, my memoir, is actually my first piece of continuous prose. So that's another thing that I've done very, very late in life.
Working as an actor, did that change the way you approached playwriting?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I mean, I'd always tried to give the actors a good evening. In other words, very early on, I wrote a play in which a barman just had to say, that'll be a shilling, thank you very much. And it did occur to me when I went into the theatre that that actor was having an absolutely miserable evening. And from that point on, I always tried to write plays in which every part was worth acting. And I was very proud of writing a play which was never done here, but was done in England, called Gethsemane. And it had eight parts, and every person in the play thought they had the best part. And once the actors feel that, it communicates a special thing to the audience, because if an actor feels, oh my goodness, I'm doing something that really is worth doing, that creates a very positive energy in the theatre. I'd always been sympathetic to actors, but when they'd said the ashtray has to be 6 inches away from my hand, not 3 inches, I'd kind of go, yeah, I'll move the ashtray 3 inches. It wasn't till I did it myself that I understood how important it was
right.
That the ashtray be exactly where you can reach it, not 3 inches away.
So you've become more sympathetic.
I became a great deal more sympathetic, and actors who I am hitherto regarded as impossible and neurotic, I now realize that actually those things create a feeling of security that makes you able to do your job.
I'm going to stick to actors for a few questions, because you've worked with so many greats. And why don't we start with an actor portraying an actor, Judi Dench, in Amy's View. What was that play like, that whole experience working with Judi?
Well, Judi Dench, I've worked with a lot, you know, this at least 4 or 5 times, I think. And so I knew her very well. And when I wrote Amy's View, which was about a light comedy actress, she did not understand why I wanted her to play the part.
Did you write it with her in mind?
No. When I finished it, then Richard Eyre, the director, said, well, it's right for Judi, isn't it? I said, yeah, I think it's right for Judi. Judi read it and said, I don't understand it. I don't like it. And I don't think I can play this part.
You sound a little bit like her, actually, now. And just
do you think so?
Yes.
Yeah, she can be very firm, Judi. You know, we talked her into it. She said, well, I trust you, you know, Richard and you. So if you say I can do it. She hated the part for weeks. When she opened in it and had, you know, one of the greatest successes of her life in it, she said to me, you know, it's always the parts that I think I don't know how to do that are interesting. And she said, when I'm given a part that fits like a glove, I'm boring in the part. That part stretched her in a way that maybe she hadn't been stretched on stage for some time. And that's why she was so brilliant in it.
There are other actors that you've worked with on and off throughout the years. Do you like to work again and again with the same?
I do. And people say, oh, you know, it makes you lazy if you always work with the same people. But the fact is that it's so much of rehearsal is getting to know people whom you don't know. And if from the first day, hello, it's Bill Nye.
I was going to bring up Bill Nye.
Hello, it's Julianne Moore, or hello. If it's someone who you've already got a relationship with, you just move so much quicker. And I think you raise each other's game. And also you're much freer with each other. You know, Bill can say anything to me and I'm not going to get hurt, because the trust we have in each other goes back 35 years. We've been working together. So, you know, he's not going to upset me by what he says. You're off on the right foot from the beginning. And Bill, in my work, you know, lately, the revival of Skylight in New York and in West End is, you know, among the best work he's ever done in my work. And that's a long list. And that just came out of us knowing each other so intimately.
Are there actors or roles that you write sort of thinking that it's a bit reflecting your view or the questions that you personally ask about, you know, or wondering
I
about?
I try not to, because I think it spoils the play if the audience think, oh, here comes David Hare and he's tub-thumping about something that he's concerned about.
Because I was having this whole picture of Bill Nye as being your onstage kind of counterpart or voice.
Yeah, I mean, there is a degree to which Bill has been my alter ego. But then, you know, in the Blue Touch paper, Kate Nelligan was my alter ego. In the early years, then Kate was the actress who was in, you know, at least four of my early plays on television and in the theater. Kate really was far closer to representing who I was. I'm much happier as a girl in a play if it's me.
Kate Nelligan was in Plenty, and Meryl Streep was in Plenty, and Cate Blanchett was in Plenty. What is it like to see your work performed by such incredibly talented but very different actresses, and does it sort of change your perception of your own play?
Well, you know, what always happens when my plays are revived, and I don't say this in any spirit of arrogance, but people don't believe it's the same play as the play that they saw 20 years ago or 10 years ago. You must remember that my plays have always been very controversial, particularly with the critics. And so, you know, for five people at my plays, there are two people who absolutely love it, two people who absolutely hate it, and then a fifth person who doesn't understand why both sides are getting so worked up. You know, and the number of people who've told me about dinner that they have after the show in which people go nuts on one side or the other. I've lived in rough water critically and in terms of the audience either loving me or hating me. When I first produce a play, and I describe in the book, Plenty had a catastrophic first night at the National Theatre, and it took probably 3 years, and it took Joe Papp doing it in New York for it to be accepted. And so, you know, later it came to be regarded as this classic. And when Skylight is revived, or The Judas Kiss is revived, or The Absence of War was revived, The Vertical Hour was revived, these have all been revived in the last couple of years, people say, oh, but this is not the same text. This is not how I remember it. And I said, no, when you first saw it, it shocked you because it was new and you had a reaction of horror. My first agent, Peggy Ramsey, said, the new is always ugly. And when she first saw Waiting for Godot, she thought, this is the ugliest play I've ever seen. And we're shocked by the new and The Rite of Spring. I'm not claiming I've ever written anything as good as Waiting for Godot or The Rite of Spring. Every play I've written has been new, and so it does shock people. Mm-hmm. And the first thing you do when you write something original is make people recoil. 20 years later, it's easier to see it.
How do you see the differences in between the way American audiences react to your work versus audiences back
home?
Oh,
I love the American audience because they follow the narrative as if they believed it. And so, you know, there are all these moments where they go ooh and ah because things are taking a turn that they hadn't expected. And so you might say that's a kind of literal mindedness. I prefer to think of it as a kind of involvement, a depth of involvement, which personally, if you attract it, seems to me incredibly flattering. In other words, I'm entirely happy that audiences should get lost in my work and treat it as if it were real life. That's, after all, often what you may be trying to do. And so I think there is a depth of credibility from an American audience, which I adore.
Are there particular plays that you've sort of felt American audiences, American critics got it more than they did in the UK?
I used to call New York my court of appeal, meaning that, you know, if I was overruled in the court in London, I could bring the play to New York.
And we would set things
right. The play would be much better understood. Plenty, certainly, that was part of a process with Plenty that people began to understand that play. I wrote the play called The Map of the World. It played here to that incredibly sophisticated audience that you can get, you know, people who work at the United Nations, people who work in the professions. You know, this is a city full of some of the most intelligent people on earth. Why don't they go to the theater?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is because the theater is so bloody stupid most of the time. And if you write up to that audience, then you will get them into the theater. But they're not fools. They're not going to come to the showbiz rubbish. If you can get that audience, you're getting a fantastic response.
You know. Do you consider yourself a political playwright?
Oh, totally, yeah.
And what do you think of the state of political plays right
now? Well, you know, it's like the weather, meaning that I have lived through now. You know, I've been 45 years a playwright. So I've had Political Theatre is Dead has probably come around 3 or 4 times
in my
lifetime.
Right, you've been through this before.
Right? And Political Theatre is Reinvigorated has come around 3 or 4 times in my lifetime. Probably now in Britain, I don't know how it is over here, we're back in a Political Theatre is reinvigorated. it is coming up again. And of course, it always, political theater always thrives at times of stasis when people can't find other ways of expressing dissent. There's a wonderful saying of Raymond Williams in my book, which is, if people can't have justice officially, they will have it unofficially. And that means they'll have it in the theater if they can't get it in their lives.
Are there young playwrights, or not so young playwrights, but contemporary playwrights that you're excited about, that you're inspired
by?
Yeah,
I think it's a phenomenon in England, at least. And I don't know enough about the American theater. But in England, that generation underneath mine, who are now in their 30s, 40s, 50s, were by and large not interested in the theater. They grew up with television. They grew up with the movies. And they thought the theater was not trendy. It wasn't cutting edge. It was a lot of old people shouting at each other. It didn't feel fashionable theater in that period. But what's so interesting is now young people are blasé about the technology. They're not really that interested in the television. They take their computers for granted. What they want, again, is theatre. And you've got all these young playwrights in England, particularly young women playwrights who are very, very strong in England. And they're all in their late teens, early 20s. And theatre's for them. And it's right, because theatre should be for the young. It's very unusual to have a generation of playwrights like me and the rest of the Brits, you know, Tom Stoppard and Howard Brenton and Carol Churchill, who've all been doing it for 45 years. It's very unusual that in the history of the theatre, it's almost unknown for to be people who spend a whole lifetime writing plays. So it's great that the young are interested in the theatre again.
Any names in particular, playwrights, that we should look out for if they cross over from the West End?
Annie Rice is great. Polly Stenham is great. James Graham is great. Over here, I love Frances Yachu Cowig. I think she's fantastic. There's just a whole load of really good young ones at the moment.
All right, I'm going to bring it back because this is a memoir of your youth. When you were young and looking at the theater, what was your impression of what the theater could do and sort of what inspired you?
Oh, well, you know, like all young people, I wanted to destroy the theater of my time. Harold Pinter, you know, terrible.
You wanted to bring
ball.
Him down.
John Osborne, dreadful, you know. As time went by, I became friends with both Osborne and Pinter and came to admire and understand their work. Of course, at the time, the plan was, you know, to destroy the theatre as it existed and to make a completely different kind of theatre, of course, a much more political, a much more angry, a younger theatre. That's what the young always want.
Was there a particular moment in your career when you thought, okay, I'm a playwright?
Yeah, it happened after Plenty. In other words, it took me 10 years. I started writing in 1970. And in 1978, there were, you know, when I'd written Plenty, there's again a phrase that I quote in the book, the point of art is to give the sensation without the boredom of its conveyance. And it's such a beautiful phrase. And I think that in my early plays, there was a great deal of boredom in the conveyance. And finally, with Plenty, I felt the technique matched the subject matter and that the subject matter, as it were coming across without the audience being aware of the technique, and the technique was not clumsy and wasn't getting in the way. And once I'd done that, I thought, yeah, I'm a playwright.
All right. Well, and the story of how that happened is The Blue Touch Paper by David Hare. David, thank you so much for being here. Alexandra Alter is here with an update from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So we went to a party last night.
I think your party was more fun than my party. I was in the back of the National Book Awards with all the press at a crowded little table, and I think you had a better view of the winners. But yes, it was one of the biggest events in publishing. The National Book Foundation gave out awards in four categories, and there were some surprises and some great speeches and some moving speeches.
Let's talk first about just a backgrounder on the National Book Award. Is this only for American writers?
Yes, it's for American writers, and it's for people that have published a book basically in the last year and the last couple of months of the previous year. And the four categories are fiction, nonfiction, young people's literature, and poetry. So it's a pretty select crowd, and it was established in 1950. It's gone to some of, you know, the best writers, the most famous writers in the country.
So they have five judges for each of these groups, and those judges rotate every year. So it's a kind of highly subjective process when they come up with a long list, which is relatively new, right?
Yes, this is just the third year that they've done the long list. And I mean, it sort of was invented as a way to drum up publicity for the awards, but also to shed light on some great books to sort of widen the pool of authors that get recognition for their work.
Let's go right to the winners, and then we can talk about any exciting controversies
yes.
or lack thereof. Let's go in reverse alphabetical order, which is how the host last night, Andy Borowitz, described the process, starting with young adult literature. Who won?
So that was Neil Schusterman, who won for Challenger Deep, which is a novel about a mentally ill teenager who has sort of dark fantasies and hallucinations about traveling to the deepest point on the earth, which is in the ocean in the Marianas Trench. And he gave a really interesting speech about how he had kind of been inspired by his son, who has struggled with mental illness as well, and was interested in the Marianas Trench. And so that sort of cracked open the subject for him. And he brought his son up on the stage, and they sort of shared the moment.
Very moving. And then going on to poetry.
Poetry was Robin Koss Lewis, who won for her collection Voyage of the Sable Venus.
It was a debut.
It was a debut, and she took on a rather large subject with portrayals of the black female figure in, you know, ancient art up until, you know, contemporary art, and looking at her own autobiography a little bit. And she spoke a lot. I noticed in her biography that she studied Sanskrit, which was interesting, and she spoke a lot about Sanskrit epics in her acceptance speech.
Okay, let's move on to nonfiction. I think everyone knew who the winner was going to be this year.
Yes, that one was not a surprise. Ta-Nehisi Coates won for Between the World and Me, which is his collection. It's written as a letter to his son, and it's an exploration of his experience of growing up and, you know, being an adult African-American man in a society where African-American men are really targeted and under threat from police officers. And it's a very visceral and blunt book that generated a lot of conversation when it came out in July. They actually moved up the publication date after some of the early reviews came in and Toni Morrison compared.
And also because it was in the news
and
so much.
Exactly. It was so topical with the Black Lives Matter movement, with all the police violence and events that we were seeing unfold. So they moved at the publication date, and it was such a compelling topic and generated so much conversation that some booksellers were even selling it at cost because they really wanted people to buy it and read it and understand his perspective.
And people have bought it.
And they really have. It's done quite well. And he gave an incredible speech, I thought. He dedicated his award to his college friend who was shot by a police officer,
Prince Jones.
And there's more awareness now of the problem, but he, you know, said that doesn't give anyone any power to change it, including him. And he said his only power is really to say, I won't be part of this lie that we have that society's fair, that, you know, racial justice is a possibility.
I think we should describe to you a little bit the moment, because it's obviously not televised like the Oscars, but it was really touching. He was visibly moved after his own speech. And you could almost look like he was really trying to hold back his own tears as they were photographing him after
yes,
the award, when
yes.
he was talking about his friend who was killed.
And his family was with him, his parents, his wife, his sons.
A very deserving win. And let's go on to fiction, which was kind of an interesting group of shortlisted books, not necessarily the most expected, even on the shortlist.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there were two books that were critically talked about a lot this year on the shortlist, Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff and A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. Both were somewhat polarizing books among critics, and I wonder if that's why neither of them won. Those have been divisive books that some people have absolutely loved and other people have hated.
So. It was interesting because both of them sort of opened up to relatively positive reviews. And then in the case of Groff, there was a very negative review by James Wood in The New Yorker that ran late, close to the award time. And then with Yanagihara's novel, there was the Christian Lorenzen in the LRB in the London Review of Books. And then this past week, Daniel Mendelsohn in the New York Review of Books, both very negative.
As you said, following really strong reviews out of the gate. So that's sort of unusual. I feel like there hasn't been critical consensus this year about a best book of the year. So the winner was a bit of a surprise, I have to say. Adam Johnson won for his short story collection, Fortune Smiles. And, you know, he's an absolutely well-established writer. He's already run the Pulitzer Prize for his 2012 novel, The Orphan Master's Son. But I don't think people were expecting a short story collection this year. One
yes.
went to Phil Klei last year. You know, there were novels that were getting a lot of attention that were nominated. So I think that was part of a surprise. And I think you could tell in his acceptance speech that he was not expecting to win. It didn't seem like he had really prepared many remarks. And he was mostly spending his time sort of citing the other writers who were nominated.
And interestingly, one of the other nominees, Lauren Groff, reviewed the Adam Johnson for the Book Review
when it
came out. So I guess a bittersweet moment for her.
And another highlight, which I feel like we should talk about because it was not video cast, was Don DeLillo's acceptance of basically a Lifetime Achievement Award. And everyone for a moment thought, oh no, the video feed went out, what's going on? But actually he'd requested that his speech not be webcast, which I think is sort of classic Don DeLillo. You know, he's very private.
I loved his speech.
His speech was wonderful. I mean, it was so in keeping with his kind of modest demeanor. He didn't even talk about his own work or his writing process or his career. He talked about his paperback collection and what it means to him to have these books that sort of transport him back to the moment where he was when he first read them. And he was basically talking about the joys of being a reader instead of the process of being a writer, which I thought was lovely.
I thought it actually fit in nicely and unexpectedly with the Literarian Award winner James Patterson's remarks, which was really about encouraging a love of reading.
Yes.
So it was kind of nice that the evening came down to this emphasis on not the creation necessarily of the written word, but the joy, the pleasure in reading it.
Definitely.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Vowell joins us now from Montana to talk about her new book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. I want to scroll back three or four books because this is not your first book of history in the broad sense, and just ask, how did you get into this?
I mean, I started out as a sort of journalist. I was a critic and reporter, and I guess my first 10 years as a writer, like any freelance writer, I scrambled and did a lot of different things, you know, book reviews, record reviews, columns, radio documentaries, and
I wouldn't know anything about that.
So, I mean, it's a great experience brought on by the poverty of journalism. In the 90s, I started working for This American Life on public radio. And I was doing a variety of different things, you know, essays and documentaries and whatnot. And I made a documentary in which my twin sister, Amy, and I drove the Trail of Tears, which was, you know, the path of our Cherokee ancestors from their home in the southeastern United States to Oklahoma. And that was really the starting point. That changed my life, partly because I just fell in love with the process of it, of doing the research and then going out and doing the reporting and going to historic sites. When I was doing the research, I wasn't happy with a lot of the sources. I mean, I didn't find anything particularly pleasurable to read. And then
it was the Trail of Tears.
Yeah. I mean, you know, well written, right. You know, I mean, reading can be pleasurable for different reasons, I think. So anyway, I could see how if one attempted to tell historical stories in a clear and hopefully engaging way, there was room for that. And then all the mail I got after that story aired was mostly from people saying, I didn't know about this. Thank you for telling me about it. I sat down with my children at the kitchen table. We talked about American Indian genocide, and it just all kind of clicked.
The Trail of Tears and Native American history in general is probably undercovered territory. But in this book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States, you turn to slightly more familiar ground, the Revolutionary War. How did you get into doing this particular book?
I had written a short piece on Lafayette a few years ago, and it was focused not on the war itself, but on the elderly Lafayette's return trip to America at the invitation of President James Monroe in 1824. When he returned to the United States almost a half century after the Revolution, it was an enormous big deal. I mean, two-thirds of the population of New York City met his ship, and every night was a party in his honor for over a year. And the American people just embraced him as one. It was this really sentimental explosion of patriotism and remembrance of the singularity of the Americans' revolution and their past. And so originally, the thing that drew me to him as a subject was that
affection and also that agreement. I mean, there are very few figures in American history that sort of call up this kind of consensus, you know. I mean, partly because he was French. So when he returned, you know, everything, all the disagreements and squabbles that were leading to the Civil War were well in hand, but because he was French and he belonged to neither North nor South, no faction, neither left nor right, he kind of belonged to the Americans as one. Just the idea of writing a story about a person Americans agreed on was very enticing to me.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, at least of this particular story. I can't resist saying the full name of Lafayette, which was Marie-Joseph Paul-Yves Roche-Gibert du Motier. Who was this young man?
Yes, I mean, he even makes fun of that name himself. He, you know, it's very, he says he was baptized like a Spaniard because he was given all the names of all these different saints to protect him in battle because he came from a military family and his ancestors, you know, were soldiers stretching back to Joan of Arc and the Crusades. And I mean, one reason as a 19-year-old boy he came over from France to volunteer with Washington's army was because the British army had killed Lafayette's soldier father in the previous war, the Seven Years' War. So he had a very personal bone to pick with the British because of that. And ever since the peace of that war, in which France was completely humiliated and lost, you know, a lot of its major possessions, most notably Canada, the French had nursed this vitriolic grudge against the British. So Lafayette's personal story reflected the larger French hatred of the British that ultimately goaded the French government into an absolute monarchy, into aiding these anti-monarchist punks in America, precisely because, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But meanwhile, France was still, you know, completely nearly bankrupt from that war. So they were at peace with Britain, and Lafayette, like a lot of his other soldier fellows in the French and other European armies, like his father, he wanted glory on the battlefield. And in order to achieve that, you need a battle. So that was another reason he came to America. I mean, he was 19 years old, and he just had these dreams of fame and glory. He wasn't going to get that in the French army.
So he comes here at 19. Where does he land, and where does he go while he's here? Because you followed him in researching this book. You went place to place.
I mean, he's just a man in love. He says, you know, back in France, when he first heard of the American cause, it just kind of lit him up, and that was all he could think about. And so he lands in South Carolina. Every step of his trip north, he's supposed to go to Philadelphia to get a commission from the Continental Congress. So he lands in South Carolina and kind of slowly makes his way north through, you know, several very humid, buggy states. And he enjoys the tramp immensely. Some of the other Frenchmen in his party are not pleased with the accommodations in 18th century American wildernesses. So they set out, I mean, I think he writes his wife, "We're setting out in a carriage and now that's broken down. And probably by the time I write you again, we'll just be on foot," which is essentially what happened. So they get to Philadelphia and he, you know, he's basically saying, "I'm here." Right. And the Continental Congress basically says, you know, "Go away," because all of these swarms of Frenchmen have been coming in droves to volunteer and to sign up with the American cause because they're out of work, you know, because Europe is at peace. But Lafayette, he wins them over. He volunteers to work for free, which is very attractive to our tax protester founders. He endears himself to George Washington and the troops and ultimately the American people because he's just so gung-ho. He's always up for it. He always volunteers. He's a very hard worker. He never shirks. He's just stalwart. Meanwhile, you know, a lot of Washington's other troops are just deserting in droves because there isn't enough food or there aren't any shoes, and the only time they get paid during the war is toward the end when Rochambeau, the French general, shares some of his Spanish gold coins with Washington to pay Washington's troops. So unlike a lot of the Americans in Washington's command, Lafayette is just gung-ho at every step of the war.
And he goes to all 24 of the United States at that time. Did you then go to all 24 of the states that he traveled to while writing this book?
Oh, in 1824. I didn't on this trip. I mean, I've been to all of them. I think I've been to 49 states. I guess I haven't been to Alabama. But that he went to all of the states later when he came back, which was, I mean, he was probably not the only person on earth who may have done that at that point in 1824. But he had this love for America and its people right from the get-go, like right when he arrives in South Carolina. And he always uses incredibly rosy language to describe the landscape. And, you know, later on when he's leading his division toward Rhode Island, he talks about the ride from New York State to Rhode Island across a smiling country. And part of that came from, I think, he was a country boy. You know, he came from Auvergne, which is a landlocked agricultural province. And he lived there until he was 11 years old and was sent to Paris to go to school. But I think his country background really, that endeared him to the Americans and they to him, because, I mean, one reason I think he left Paris and Versailles was he wasn't really comfortable there, you know. I mean, he had actually, right before he left, he had danced with Marie Antoinette at Versailles and stepped on her feet and she made fun of him, you know. So he loved the countryside and the American people living there. And that never wavered.
Your title, you call it Lafayette in the somewhat United States. I think I can kind of guess what you meant by that, but what did you mean? Tell us.
Well, I mean, the joke was sort of on me in that I was drawn to the topic because, you know, Americans embraced Lafayette as one, and there was so much agreement about him. But at every step in the story, I had to research and write, there's all this bickering and squabbling going on amongst the Americans in the background. You know, the Continental Congress and the Continental Army were constantly at odds. The American people weren't really cohesive. You know, there were just so many different religions. Some of the Americans were actually loyalists. When he comes back in 1824, it coincides with one of the most rancorous presidential elections in American history.
So nothing has changed.
Researching the book, there's something Lafayette says before he comes to the United States. His father-in-law had tried to get him this really boring job at the French court, and Lafayette, you know, was rude to the king's brother and got out of that, and he explained it later, saying, "I did not hesitate to be disagreeable to preserve my independence." And at every point in this story, whether the story of the past or the one that I'm encountering as I research the story, that disagreeability, I came to have a real soft spot for it.
Well, it all sounds very familiar then. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
The book again is Lafayette in the Somewhat United States by Sarah Vowell, reviewed this week in the Book Review by Charles Pierce. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
Bestseller News and a cold. I have to apologize in advance for my scratchy voice. Fortunately, there's not a lot new on the list this week. We've got 4 new titles on the hardcover fiction list and just 1 over on nonfiction. Starting with fiction, the first new title is down at number 9. It's by Isabel Allende. It's a new novel called The Japanese Lover, which follows 7 decades in the life of a couple, a Polish immigrant to the U.S. who comes here in 1939 fleeing the Nazi invasion and falls in love with the son of her host family, her aunt and uncle's Japanese gardener. And so it's the relationship between the Japanese immigrant and the Polish immigrant. Then at number 7, Robert Cray continues his Elvis Cole mystery series, mystery thriller series, with a novel called The Promise, new at number 7. At number 6, another series, Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child are back with the 15th thriller about Aloysius Pendergast, the FBI agent. That novel is called Crimson Shore, new at number 6. Finally, new at number 4, Mitch Albom is back on the list with a novel called The Magic Strings of Frankie Presto. The premise of this one, it's kind of like a musical Forrest Gump. It's a supernaturally gifted guitar player who, over the course of the 20th century, influences the course of musical history in the century. On the nonfiction side, it's just one new title. All the way up at number 1, John Meacham's biography of George Herbert Walker Bush, Destiny and Power, is new at number 1. It's gotten a lot of strong attention, especially against the backdrop of the current Republican campaign for president.
And, of course, he was a guest on the podcast last week. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Sure. Thank you, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.